From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, we sample the music that's currently being used to increase Ebola awareness in West Africa, and Cameron Esposito explains why she didn't realize she was gay until she left her hometown.
For me, where I grew up, I honestly think it would have been as difficult for me to realize I was a lesbian as it would have been for me to realize I was a leprechaun.
How Norman Lear's own dysfunctional family gave us so much great TV.
Well, that's where it all came from. You know, we all scraped the barrels of our own experience.
A look behind the scenes of one of the greatest films ever, The Princess Bride.
People ask us, was it as much fun as it looked making this film? And I always say to them, it was more fun than you think.
And Flying Lotus comes into the studio to talk about the wide musical palette he uses to illustrate the life that comes after death. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Music has been a tool of public health campaigns across Africa. Songs have been used to spread information in the fight against diseases like malaria and AIDS. Now in West Africa, Liberian musicians are singing to educate people about how to keep from getting infected with the Ebola virus. NPR's Jason Bobian stopped by Sky FM in the Liberian capital Monrovia to talk with one DJ about the latest Ebola songs that are dominating his playlist.
Elliot Adekoya is a 31-year-old musician and disc jockey who's known as the milkman.
Every life is given through the milk. Your mother breastfeed you with milk.
Adekoya views himself as the milk that produces the music. Yesterday, he was working the midday on-air shift at one of Monrovia's most popular pop stations, Sky FM. Early on in the epidemic, the government and aid agencies commissioned public awareness songs, but they actually ended up terrifying people. The message was, there's no cure. Don't touch anybody. Stop eating bushmeat.
It used to be a death sentence to people, so it scared people away. And that's how people started running away from one community to another community. And people saw it like it was like a curse.
He says people have started to see that you can survive this disease. And he says listeners don't want to hear those despondent messages all the time on the radio.
The Ebola scenario is something that people don't want to listen to anymore because they're so fed up, they're so sick of it. So if you're making a song, an Ebola song that people going to listen to, now it has to be danceable. Protect your family. Protect your community. Because Ebola.
He says one of the most popular songs right now is by F.A. and Soul Fresh called Ebola is Real. It tells people to protect themselves from getting infected. He says two of the most powerful phrases are the thing, Ebola, now come, and the thing now show face.
The thing now come, the thing now show face. Yeah, you know, that's the thing the children enjoy. Once you go around, people be like, no shaking him, I mean the thing now come, the thing now show face. In the Liberian way, when they say the thing now come, it means the thing is here. Now we know it's here, and it has shown its face. So we all understand that it's in our midst now. We got to be careful.
Let somebody, please tell somebody to tell somebody that Ebola is real. Somebody, please tell somebody to tell somebody that Ebola is here.
Radio remains an incredibly powerful medium in West Africa. It blasts from shops. Young men crank it up in rust bucket taxis. You hear it playing from simple shacks and tidy stucco homes.
Fast becoming the anthem for Ebola.
In addition to the Ebola songs, announcers are regularly talking about the disease. They urge people to stay away from dead bodies, regularly wash your hands, get to a treatment center right away if you have symptoms. Some of the most popular Ebola songs get played over and over again. The chorus of "Ebola is real" wafts all over the city. But it's not just pop music that has taken on the epidemic. There are R&B songs, rap, slow jams, Afro pop tunes.
Word is in disarray. Ebola is everywhere. People dying every day.
Adekoya at Sky FM says music is having an impact. It's a way to express frustration and let off steam. It's a way to remind people how to stay away from the virus. It's a way for Liberians to come together in the face of a terrifying illness. He's particularly excited about a project called Save Liberia. It's sort of a local version of We Are the World, and it brings together 45 of the country's most famous musicians.
The Save Liberia project is the main project that I'm looking forward to, and I just want to see how it's going to turn things around.
And Adekoya believes it will have an impact on this epidemic because he has faith in the power of music. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Monrovia.
Our eyes are filled with fear. Our eyes are filled with tears.
Hear me.
When Mary Lambert sang the hook on Macklemore's 2012 hit, Same Love, her career transformed.
I mean, around this time, I'm playing venues to like six people, including my mom. Like, this is not happening for me.
She went from performing at coffee shops in Seattle to performing on Ellen at the MTV Music Video Awards and at the Grammys.
And I can't change, even if I try. Even if I wanted to, and I can't change, even if I try.
Now at 25, Mary Lambert is releasing her debut album, Heart on My Sleeve. She came by NPR West to talk about it, but I had to start by asking her about the song that made her famous. Are you sick of talking about Same Love?
No, I'm not. It's so much a part of my artistic identity, and I can't really believe that, you know, that's my breakout song, a song about gay rights and social justice and, like, existing in the pop world now. Like, that's my introduction. Like, that's pretty cool.
How did that come together?
After I graduated college, I was really experimenting in my writing, at least the feeling of living sort of a contradictory life of being a Christian and a lesbian and feeling like that I did not feel like I could coexist in both of those worlds. Like, my Christian friends were like, we love you, you're still going to hell. And my, you know, my gay friends were like, why are you hanging out with a group of people that don't value your rights? And Hollis Wongware, who sings on White Walls, she and I were friends and did poetry together. She suggested me for the song because she was good friends with Macklemore and Ryan, and she knew that that was sort of a part of my identity and something I was exploring. I was just so shocked. I was actually in the process of applying to graduate school to be a teacher. So I was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to put that degree on hold and see if I can make this happen. I wrote it in about 2 hours after that phone call. I went into that studio, met them for the first time, and recorded it that night.
Let's talk about the new album. I think if people hadn't heard you before, this is a great way to introduce you, is the song Secrets.
I've got bipolar disorder. My life's not in order. I'm overweight. I'm always late. I've got too many things to say. I rock mom jeans, cat earrings, extrapolate my feelings.
So I love how you go from a place, you know, we were talking about how you couldn't write everything in one song to where you have a song where everything's out there.
all of it, all of the baggage. I just wanted to write a song that was sort of about living unapologetically. I mean, this is a pop song, so I'm not like, I know that I can't like solve all the world's problems. There might be a nugget where it just clicks in some 13-year-old girl's head that she's valued. And it's not tied up in a pretty bow, because this is me showing you how vulnerable I am and asking you, you know, come on, it's okay to be vulnerable. You know.
Well, there's not a pretty bow, but one of the things that's wonderful is that there's so much humor through all of it. I mean, you're talking about some awful stuff at times, but you never lose the humor in there.
No, it's so important. I mean, I think all of my songs previous have been very slow and sad, and this was sort of a celebration of all of that and just being like, here it is, it's out on the page, now let's dance to it. I know I'm not the only one who spent so long attempting to be someone else. Well, I'm over it.
Speaking with Mary Lambert about her new album, Heart on My Sleeve. Can you tell me a little bit about your shows? Because I've not seen one of your performances, but from what I've heard, they sound not like a concert that I've been to before. You're big into poetry. You do a lot of spoken word as part of it, right?
Yeah. The shows are like it just feels like a giant hug. You know, people come in, I'm like, welcome to the emotional roller coaster. Because I talk about body image. I talk about things that are uncomfortable. Because I think the things that are uncomfortable are usually things that are shrouded in guilt and shame. And I want to dismantle all of that.
You have spoken word in several parts on the record. There's one track, Dear One, that's just a poem.
Where did you come from, bright star? What heaven did you leap from, dear love?
Why did you pick that one to put in?
I guess the kind of poems that I was used to writing primarily had to do with social justice and gay rights and things like this. And so for me, this was actually a step in, like, poetry can be about just love, and you can just talk about it in that way.
I was halved the moment I was born. The other piece of me is inside of your mouth. And I was found whole the moment you spoke.
Pretty much everything on here is original, but you do a cover of Rick Springfield's Jessie's Girl.
Yeah.
And for people who might roll their eyes at Rick Springfield, I just want to say listen to this song, because it's a pretty powerful ballad.
Jessie is a friend. Yeah, I know he's been a good friend of mine. But lately something's changed, it ain't hard to define. Jessie's got himself a girl, and I want to make her mine.
I loved that song so much. I also love the gender-neutral name Jessie. I think it's applicable for anybody that's pined after a woman that they couldn't have, you know. But I think it's especially resonant in, like, the gay community when you, like, pine after a straight girl. You're like, oh, gosh, I wish I had Jessie's girl, you know.
I wish that I had Jessie's girl. I wish that I had Jessie's girl. Where can I find a woman like that?
You talked about how you're writing and performing music that has messages you wish you had heard when you were 19 or even younger.
Yeah.
Are you having young people coming up to you now and connecting with you? And
big time. It's a really, really emotional experience. The ones that really get me, I get probably about one or two emails a week of girls who are in rehab for eating disorders. To feel like I've been a catalyst for someone else's healing is really incredible. Like, as soon as I start talking about it, I start crying. I cry so much. I cry all the time. I cry happy tears.
Mary Lambert, it's been a very happy experience speaking with you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I'm glad.
That's Mary Lambert. Her new album, Heart on My Sleeve, is out Tuesday. The Auction House, Profiles in History, sits in a short, average-looking office building in Calabasas, California. But it holds some of the most famous relics in movie history.
Do you know what this is? This is the Indiana Jones whip.
Sabrina Proper works at the Auction House.
Cool. This is the Citizen Kane jacket worn by Orson Welles.
There are Wolverine's claws from X-Men, a crown from Game of Thrones. And next Saturday, Profiles in History will sell Lot 1121. What the Auction House says is the last remaining authentic motorcycle from the 1969 film Easy Rider. The Captain America motorcycle that Peter Fonda rode in the film, with the American flag paint job and the long front end. The bike is like the movie, legendary. But for many years, the history of who built it has been largely unknown. NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports.
What do you say we take a look at these super machines we've been hearing so much about? Let's get it on.
The Captain America bike was not simply taken out of a showroom and in front of the camera. It was handmade, what's known as a chopper.
It's a type of customized motorcycle, usually defined by a stretched out wheelbase and pulled back handlebars and a wild paint job. I mean, those are sort of the cliche indicators.
That's Paul d'Orléans. He's an expert on vintage motorcycles and the author of The Chopper, The Real Story. He says the bikes and Easy Rider embodied chopper culture of the 1960s and took it mainstream.
They did more to popularize choppers around the world than any other film or any other motorcycle. I mean, suddenly people were building choppers in Czechoslovakia or Russia or China or Japan.
But d'Orléans says while the two Easy Rider bikes became icons, the names of the builders remained obscure.
Most choppers, it's associated with who built this because they are an artistic creation. And curiously, the Easy Rider bikes were never associated with any particular builder.
Here's where the story gets complicated and conflicted. In the past few years, with some work by d'Orléans and others, two names emerged more publicly. There's Ben Hardy, a prominent African-American motorcycle builder in Los Angeles, and Clifford Vaws, a black civil rights activist, motorcyclist, and bike builder. Hardy died in 1994. This past week, I reached Clifford Vaws, now 77 years old. Vaws says he met Peter Fonda while working for an L.A. radio station. Fonda had been arrested for marijuana possession, and Vaws was sent to cover the court proceedings. They got to talking.
And so we talked about motorcycles. He asked me what I was doing. I said, I have a hobby on the side. I build motorcycles.
Sometime after, Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda came over to Vaws' place in West Hollywood. They talked about making a motorcycle movie.
I said, well, I can build whatever we need for the film right here at my place.
That movie would become Easy Rider. Vaws maintains he came up with the bike's signature elements and coordinated their construction, which also involved Ben Hardy and others. Larry Marcus is a mechanic. He lived with Vaws at the time and worked on the bikes.
Okay, Cliff really came up with the design for both motorcycles.
Before his death in 2010, director and star Dennis Hopper also credited Vaws. In the past, Peter Fonda has said he himself designed the bikes. Fonda's publicist said that he was unavailable for comment on this story. Vaws and others were fired early on in the film production, and his name never appeared in the credits. But Vaws also believes the contribution of African Americans has been conspicuously left out of the story of Easy Rider.
And you know, those bikes, I mean, when we talk about iconic, they are definitely iconic. But yet, the participation of blacks, completely suppressed. And I say suppressed because no one talks about it.
Now, 45 years after the film's release, Vaws has still never seen the film. When I asked him why, he responded simply,
"What for?"
Vaws says he's troubled that the film depicts 60s bike culture but has no African-American characters. At the time, he belonged to the Chosen Few, a motorcycle club that was racially integrated. That reality doesn't appear on screen. The Profiles in History auction house notes the role of Hardy and Vaws in building the bikes, but acquisitions manager Brian Chanis says what happened to them is sadly typical in Hollywood.
The guys that are back there doing the welding, the guys that are doing the set building, that are really masters of their craft, they don't get the props. You know, that's it. They don't get the notoriety, unfortunately.
And Clifford Vaws still has mixed feelings about this very short chapter in a long life.
What can I say? Simply, I'm a little miffed about this, but there's nothing I can do.
He says he's not looking for credit. Vaws says he knows the work he did in his backyard all those years ago. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Every sitcom on TV today lives in the shadow of Norman Lear. Not only did he pretty much create the modern TV sitcom, he showed its potential to do a lot more than just make people laugh. Name a sensitive social issue. Odds are one of the Norman Lear comedies took it on. He also created more roles and opportunities for African Americans on TV, with shows like Good Times, The Jeffersons, and Sanford and Son. Lear credits that to growing up Jewish in America and feeling like an outsider himself.
What I experienced as a kid had a deep, profound, and constant influence on me. I saw myself as a member of a minority, had great empathy for myself, and then it flowed into other minorities who had more severe problems than I did.
Lear's new memoir is called Even This I Get to Experience, and what a life. On top of the backstory to all that great TV, we learn about his combat experience in World War II and growing up in a family that was more outrageous than anything he put on television. Lear actually spent several years living with cousins when his father went to jail for white-collar crime.
I can't get past calling him a rascal. I mean, he stole, he lied, he cheated. But that is so uncomfortable for me to think about. I rather think of him as a rascal.
And your mother's quite a character as well. It's kind of unbelievable to me how her reactions to your accomplishments are kind of meh.
She never saw me as anything past 9 years of age, I think. The best thing she could say about me was I used to like falling down the stairs to make people laugh.
Obviously, that didn't affect your confidence. Where does that come from?
Can you say beats the shit out of me on NPR?
Sure, we can bleep you. It's fine.
Okay. But you can bleep it in a way that you know I said it, won't you?
Absolutely. Let's go right to All in the Family, because that's a show that's such an important part of American culture. I thought I'd heard all the kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. I had no idea, though, how difficult it was for you getting that on the air.
Well, it took 3 years or a little more to get it on the air. I made it for one network, ABC. There were only three at the time. I made it for ABC originally. They wouldn't put it on and couldn't jettison it. So they used the contract to ask me to make a second show a year later. I didn't change the script. I just simply did it again. Same leads, Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton. And they, again, didn't put it on, but this time they lost it. And a year later, CBS had a new executive, and he wanted a brand that would feel like him, and he picked up All in the Family.
And even CBS, though, they were nervous and second-guessing right up until seconds before it went on the air.
Yes, yeah. There was one line. Archie and Edith come in from church when they're not expected because Archie didn't care for the sermon and they left. And Mike and Gloria in the house alone have decided to go upstairs.
They're the young newlyweds.
Yeah, the young newlyweds, yeah.
But we have to be downstairs to yell surprise.
They'll be downstairs. Let them yell surprise.
And Archie comes in.
Hi.
You're early.
Archie sees what they were, knows basically what they were up to, and says...
11:10 of a Sunday morning.
11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. They wanted that line out. And when I said, but why? Well, because he's putting his finger on what they were doing. I mean, 11 o'clock on a Sunday, what else? Well, I said, well, what's the problem with that? They're a married couple. Nothing happened. The camera saw nothing. And they were still... Can't do it, can't do it. I just had a sense that if they won this battle, which was almost silly, that would dictate the nature of the show, and I couldn't do that. So I said, clearly, if that goes on the air, or do the show without me. And it went on the air, and believe me, no state seceded from the Union. America lived with it.
Well, what about, like, you know, beyond worrying about particular lines, explain the pushback more broadly. What was it that was making ABC at first and then other people uncomfortable about this program?
Well, they were listening to an American bigot.
Archie Bunker.
They were listening to Archie Bunker. They had not heard those attitudes expressed, although you could hear them on a playground anywhere in America. I mean, it was no big deal. I'm saying that now with hindsight because we went on the air and... The first show, because they were so fearful, they had hundreds of telephone operators, literally, ready to go to pick up the phone calls, the complaints. And it wasn't enough to trouble six operators. So America, you know, was living what they knew very well because Archie Bunker's lived next door or right in the house with them.
If you had to do a TV show today, what would it be? Do you have a pitch?
Yeah, I would wish to get the generations below mine and mine, you know, from 55 or 60 up on television. I love Betty White, but she does not make a full demographic. Certainly, they're the fastest growing demographic with the most expendable income. There's every reason in the world for a show to exist. Ask me the title of what I want to do.
What's the title of what you want to do?
Guess Who Died? The script exists if anybody's interested in putting it on.
Is there a Norman Lear character in there?
There's a Norman Lear character spread thinly in all of them, I guess. That's what I found in writing the book.
That's Norman Lear, writer and producer behind All in the Family and way too many great shows to name. His new memoir is called Even This I Get to Experience, and it's out on Tuesday. Norman Lear, it's been really wonderful speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How many movies can pull off being both earnest and ironic, both cynical and romantic, and laugh-out-loud funny? I can only think of one, The Princess Bride. For many of you, I know those lines are already running through your head.
Marriage. Marriage is what brings us together.
Hello! My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
As you wish.
Oh, my sweet Wesley. What have I done?
Cary Elwes played young, sweet Wesley. 27 years after The Princess Bride hit theaters, he has a new book about the making of the film. Of course, it's called As You Wish. We started talking about his most difficult scene. The story called for the greatest sword fight in modern times. And director Rob Reiner insisted that Elwes and Mandy Patinkin, who played Inigo Montoya, actually be in every frame of the scene, all while delivering that classic banter.
You're using Bonetti's defense against me, huh?
I thought it fitting, considering the rocky terrain.
He assigned to us two of the greatest sword trainers we could possibly get. And they worked us every single day. I mean, if there was time between a take, even. So we never had a chance to sit down on the movie, Manny and I.
This was the last thing you filmed, almost, because it was so complex.
Right. Bob said to us at the beginning, he said, we've deliberately asked the producers to move the schedule of the sword fight sequence to the end of the movie because we need every day we can get with you just to teach you to do right-handed sword. Forget the left-handed. That's going to be a whole other thing.
Because halfway through the duel, both of you reveal that you're actually right-handed.
We're actually right-handed, moment. Correct.
There's something I ought to tell you.
Tell me. I'm not left-handed either.
I mean, I got to tell you, we really worked hard at it, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, speaking of that, there are a lot of funny people, a lot of funny scenes in this film. Was there one in particular where you had the hardest time keeping it together not cracking up?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it has to be Billy Crystal. I mean, there's no question.
Miracle Max.
I mean, forget it.
We need a miracle. It's very important.
Look, I'm retired.
And you had to play Dad.
I had to play Dad. I heard Rob go over to Billy. I remember him saying to him, yeah, just go for it. And he basically gave Billy free rein to do medieval Yiddish stand-up and throw away all the pages for the scene.
Sir, we're in a terrible rush.
Don't rush me, sonny. You rush a miracle, man, you get right miracles.
And then he walked over to me and he said, now listen, you have to be dead in this scene, so we can't even see you breathe, we can't see your chest move.
Hello in there! Hey, what's so important? What you got here, that's worth living for.
First person to be banned from the set because his laugh is so loud is Rob. Then I lost it, and so they replaced me with my rubber dummy. And then Mandy had tried so hard to hold in his laugh, he actually bruised a rib.
He didn't get hurt in the sword fight.
Didn't get hurt anywhere during the filming other than trying to hold in his laugh with Billy Crystal.
It's funny often with classic films when you get the backstory, you hear horrible stuff. It's like Singing in the Rain. They were all miserable the entire
really?
Time.
Or, were they really?
Well, yeah, apparently
no.
it was pretty
God,
tough
going. I love that movie.
But this, it sounds like you guys were just having a blast.
Oh, it was more fun than you think. We had an incredible director in Rob. He knew we were going on this journey, and he wanted to make sure he surrounded himself with people that he wanted to spend time with and have fun with. And that's what he got.
Now, a lot of the younger fans of the film probably aren't aware that this was not a huge blockbuster success at the time. I mean, I was in high school when it came out. I didn't even remember seeing trailers or ads for it. I saw
it
on video.
They pulled the trailer. Fox pulled the trailer. They would actually stump the marketing department, God bless them, because they'd never come across a film that had so many genres in it. You know, was it a comedy? Was it an adventure film? Was it a kids' film? Was it a fairy tale? Was it an adult movie? And, of course, it was all these things, you see. And they didn't know how to pitch it. The film came and did some modest business, respectable, modest, but not the kind of money that they'd hoped. And it wasn't until about almost a decade later when VHS came out that the film found its legs again. From a film that had been mostly dead, it was suddenly alive again. And then it became this huge hit.
When did you start to get a sense then that this was a very special film to a lot of people?
I was in a restaurant in New York. And I was ordering, I think, a hamburger, and the waitress said, "How do you want that done?" And I said, "Medium rare." And she said, "As you wish." And I looked up at her and I went, "What did you just say?" And she winked and walked off, and I thought, oh. And so it was a wonderful, delightful rebirth, if you will.
And you found out that Bill Clinton was a fan, and I bring this up because I know you do a good Bill Clinton impression.
That was amazing. I got to go to the White House. I worked on a show called From the Earth to the Moon, which Tom Hanks produced for HBO.
About the Apollo, the moon
Apollo
missions.
Space program, yeah. For the Millennium series at the White House, the president screened our episode, Apollo 11. And so we flew out to Washington, and finally we found ourselves standing in front of him, my wife and I. And I put out my hand and I said, "Mr. President, my name is..." And he stopped me and he goes, "I know exactly who you are, Carrie." And I thought, wow, how does he know me? This is crazy, you know? I mean, you know, I was in the movie, sure, but... And he goes, no, it's not what you think. Chelsea and I are big fans of The Princess Bride. We've seen it over 100 times. I know every line. I love that movie. And I just was dumbfounded. I couldn't believe it. There you go. You never know where your fans are going to be.
Carrie Elwes, his new book is called As You Wish. It's about the making of The Princess Bride. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I have to ask, can you just give us an As You Wish before
sure.
we go?
Sure. As You Wish.
Some musical instruments are so important, you can read their biographies online. I'm talking about Stradivarius violins. Several hundred survive, and they're so prized you can trace their lineages through the great musicians who have played them over the centuries. The instruments have been valued at prices ranging from hundreds of thousands to several million dollars, which attracts a lot of non-musicians, like investors and thieves. As NPR's Daniel Hajduk reports, there's a lot of intrigue when one of these priceless instruments goes missing.
Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra concertmaster Frank Almond had just finished a performance on a frigid Wisconsin night in January. With a rare Lipinski Stradivarius violin slung over his shoulder, he walked out into the freezing parking lot towards his car.
Walked briskly to my car and noticed an unusual Scooby-Doo-looking van backed in next to my car, and it was running.
As Almond put the violin case in his back seat, he noticed someone getting out of the van.
I thought, why is he getting closer, and why is he trying to take my picture?
The flashing light Almond thought was a camera flash was actually a taser.
Very jarring electric shock, like when you get hit with 50,000 volts or so, I suppose.
Almond hit the ground, and the van sped out of the parking lot. The Lipinski Stradivarius, worth between $5 and $6 million, was gone. Stradivarius instruments, also known as Strads, are worth so much because there are so few left, only about 650. The maker, a 17th and 18th century Italian luthier named Antonio Stradivari, is considered the best there ever was. He crafted violas, cellos, and harps, but the sound of his violins seemed to get better with age. To truly understand the value of a centuries-old Stradivarius, you have to see one up close. Nicolette Cacciardi unzips a plain brown violin case. Inside, olive-green velvet padding and underneath a silk cloth is a Stradivarius known as the Duke of Alcantara, after its original owner. Cacciardi is a graduate student at UCLA. The school owns this Strad, made in 1732, worth around $2 million.
It's very light compared to any violin I've held. I never had anything this precious in my hands.
It's usually locked away in a vault on campus, but now Cacciardi gets to play it for the first time.
Yeah, it's very sensitive. It's like a really nice car that you just lightly push the pedal and then it's zooming by.
According to UCLA, back in the 1960s, this Strad was also stolen. Either that, or the man who had it on loan accidentally left it on the roof of his car and drove off. Either way, it was found beside a freeway on-ramp. That's the story, at least. And each Stradivarius has some story of survival. Back in Milwaukee, days went by without a trace of the Lipinski Stradivarius, which was on loan to concertmaster Frank Almond. It seemed like the perfect crime. Even before the instrument was stolen, the thief had watched Almond's every move.
Yeah, the guy knew where I lived. He knew my kids' names. This was a very, very premeditated incident that was on this guy's mind for at least 5 or 6 years.
One detail that was overlooked, though, was that an item that hot can't stay hidden for very long. The Milwaukee Police Department and the FBI worked quickly. At a local news conference 1 week after the theft, Police Chief Edward Flynn approached the podium.
Well, today the Milwaukee Police Department is pleased and very proud to announce the safe recovery of the Lipinski Stradivarius violin.
Police had discovered it, undamaged, the night before.
In a suitcase stored in the attic of the residence.
Two men were arrested, including the mastermind behind the theft, who pleaded guilty this month to felony robbery. Now the violin is safely back in the hands of Frank Almond.
It's survived wars and revolutions and most recently somebody trying to steal it.
Just another story of survival to add to this 299-year-old Lipinski Stradivarius violin. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
If you haven't heard the music of Flying Lotus, that's the stage name of Stephen Ellison, man, is it hard to describe. I think the only way to do it is to say it's whatever it needs to be. In trying to evoke the widest range of human feelings, he might reach to hip-hop, jazz, rock, electronic, or avant-garde sounds the way a painter reaches for different colors. Flying Lotus calls on all the colors of his musical rainbow on his new album, You're Dead. It's a concept album that explores what happens to human consciousness when you die.
I wanted to make a record that started at the moment of death, you know, the perceived idea of what death is, you know. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you hit the play button, you know, it's on. And then it's the whole journey through the afterlife, you know, through the kind of like Tibetan Book of the Dead idea of what it means to die and to go into different dimensions and the bardos, as they put it.
Yeah, that's actually in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's all about that particular moment in consciousness when you die, basically. It's supposed to be a guide through that. Is this album like a guide?
I don't know if I would call it a guide. It really just, to me, it's my opportunity to make a film, you know, in a way. It was really fun. Is despite how it might come off morbid or something like that, it was actually, I didn't want it to feel like that. I wanted it to feel maybe at times confusing. Sometimes it's beautiful, sometimes you know, you have this kind of grasp on where you're at, you know what this all means, you know, and then it changes into something else, and that's kind of what I think the next place might be like.
Well, it covers a lot of textures, which is, I guess, what that end of life moment is supposed to be like. You sort of reflect through everything. There's anger here, there's happiness, there's confusion.
Yeah, it's funny, man, because, you know, A lot of times I think about what it must have been like for Michael Jackson to die. I don't know why, but I always think about that. I always wonder if
that moment is particularly like that,
yeah,
when
the crossing over moment, what that must have been like for him, because I really feel like there's a part of him that must be like, nah, man, I'm Michael Jackson, you know, like you can't go, I'm forever, you know, maybe that made it easier or something, who knows, but I always wonder what it must have been like.
And you had fun with some amazing collaborators,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, first one I want to talk about is Herbie Hancock,
yeah,
the amazing pianist. Well, I should say keyboardist, because,
right,
and I can,
yeah,
see the affinity here. He was one of the first jazz men of that generation to really embrace,
yeah,
electronics.
Bring it into the fold. Yeah, absolutely. Working with him was so cool, because trying to do a jazz record for me, like starting off as a jazz record, starting from that place, it's not necessarily my first language, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what would be your first language? Because you got a lot of different languages you speak.
I think I come from hip hop.
Yeah,
I come from that. That's where I started. I started on 4-bar loops with samples and stuff. But you know, having Herbie Hancock, his interest and his involvement and his support, it really just gave me a lot of confidence to pursue the concept and pursue the record. You know, there's a bit of me that was just like a little worried that, oh man, what if I won't be able to get my ideas across? What if he thinks I'm an idiot? Because there were plenty of times where I was like, man, am I just going a little too far down the deep end with this concept thing? Like,
so was Herbie Hancock there saying, yeah, go deeper. Yeah,
yeah,
it's your dad. Do,
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Do it.
Well, you know, I'm playing him stuff, and he just made these crazy faces, and he's like, yeah, I get it. You know, like yes, that. That's it. That's it. And yes.
Speaking with Flying Lotus about his new album, it's called You're Dead. Let's talk about the hip hop side of things. You,
sure,
you have Snoop Dogg on this album.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You know, I think to anyone who doesn't really know about me or know my history, it might come off as a little weird, but Snoop, his music was the first music I genuinely fell in love with,
yeah,
as a kid, as a teenager. I heard the Doggy Style album and I was 10 years old, and you know, that was like, I was perfectly primed for that album. I was like starting to be rebellious, I was starting to hate everything, you know, and like, you know, I started to see the dark side of the world. And then there's this guy from LA with these beats that sound like LA, and it was just perfect. And it changed me, man. I always wanted to make music after that. And to have Snoop on there and the way that he's on the album, he's like a gatekeeper. You know, he's
one of the Bardos, one of,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
the
yeah,
Death,
yeah,
States.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a Bardo demon.
Yeah, exactly.
Snoop Dogg.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that. And it's just perfect. It's perfect that it's him. Nickel played it, nah, 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 bang, bang, blow your mind, beat, flat line, you gotta get yours, I've been had mine, hold my hand, laying in the bed, family crying, they think he dead, no jokes, no hoax, don't just call me up, no hoax.
We should talk about the ending of this album.
Yeah.
Are these the voices of the dead that we're hearing at the,
yeah,
end?
Yeah, they are. What I wanted to have at the ending was kind of the protest against the notion that we're dead. This isn't the end. Our shell is dead, but we live forever. All of our influence lives on forever. You know, and that's something that I always have to remind myself too. You know, like when I lost my mother, it affected me heavily, you know, and I was so broken by it. But, you know, I have a little sister, and, you know, she's grown up to be just like my mother and so many ways, and ways that kind of freak me out a little bit, because, you know, how does she develop that? But, you know, it's like my mom, she lives on through my sister. That's just how it is. I don't ever feel like it's the end anymore.
That's Flying Lotus, his new album.
Good way to end it up.
New album is called You're Dead. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you.
For the week ending October 12, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, Denise Guerra, and Eliza Mills. Our intern is Chloe Prisinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Delagila and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.